when a military man is at the height of his career and marching his battalions off to war. He's fought numerous engagements for his country far and near in serving his apprenticeship to Mars. And he naturally accumulates some decorative scars in serving his apprenticeship to Mars.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, January 30th, 2011. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning we have Michael Portantier and Matthew Murray. Michael is a writer and journalist for many outlets. Some of his writing can be found at npr.org, as well as his photography at Followspots Photo, and he also writes for Broadway Stars. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, James.
Also with us is Matthew Murray. Matthew is the chief theater critic for TalkinBroadway.com, also writes for Broadway Stars. And good morning, Matthew.
Hey, James. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you. So we had a few shows open off Broadway, The New York Idea. Matthew, why don't you jump right into it and give us what you think?
Well, it's actually kind of interesting because The New York Idea is a play that was written by Langdon Mitchell and premiered on Broadway in 1906. Now, if you don't know who Langdon Mitchell is, you're actually excused. He was sort of a playwright around the turn of the 20th century, but a lot of his work has been forgotten. Maybe the best known thing of his today, and I use best really, really loosely here, is his adaptation of Vanity Fair that was called Becky Sharp and that ran for a while. And that occasionally gets done, or at least it's something that people have heard of. But he's probably known sort of tangentially more than anything else for his relationship with Mrs. Fisk, or Minnie Madden Ern Fisk, as she's known, who was kind of a famous actress back in that time. And she appeared in a number of his plays, and they had a good working relationship together. But The New York Idea is a play that has been forgotten because time and social mores have sort of moved on and left it behind. It's about two different couples in really the high echelons of New York society who are both divorced and considering marrying other people. Basically, Philip Fillmore is a lawyer, a very high-powered lawyer, and he's marrying Cynthia Karslake, who is sort of low upper class, I guess is a good way to put it. She's really into horses, and I don't mean breeding them. I mean racing them and watching the races and all that. And she was previously married to John Karslake, but left him because of issues of quote-unquote constancy and felt that he wasn't able to give her the sort of consistent life that she wanted. And Philip was previously married to a woman named Vida, and they divorced, and she is really sort of this a little bit of a free spirit, but still very concerned about social niceties and propriety and all that. And basically the entire play is about what happens when these four people get mixed up trying to sort out who should be with whom and why and what's appropriate and what's not in society at this time. Now, as the description suggests, this is a play that probably dated very quickly. It received, I think, another very well-received production in 1915, but it's basically been gone since then for obviously the reasons that divorce is much more common now. People don't see it as the embarrassing thing that it once was, which has kind of made the play and a lot of the issues that it deals with obsolete in that way. So the question is, why would the Atlantic Theater Company, which is certainly better known for doing adventurous and newer works, want to take on this play? Well, I have no idea. And I would argue, in fact, that they haven't. Because what they've done is that they've gotten David Auburn, who was Pulitzer Prize winner for Proof, a very, very good play from, I think, 2000, that started at Manhattan Theater Club and then moved to Broadway, where it ran for really a long time. They've gotten him to adapt the play. And that's the term that's used in the playbill, but I think it's actually not very accurate. Because basically what he's done is he's taken the essential plot, and he's taken the most of the character names, and he has sort of kept some of the dialogue, but he's essentially written a new version of the story around them. It's not so much an adaptation as it is a new play after the original New York idea. We talked about that play after Miss Julie last year. Well, this is sort of like that. It's I don't want to say sanitized because that's not right, but it's very flattened down and it's very modernized and it's very inoffensive and it's very I don't know how to say it. It's weird that anyone would do this to a play that was once considered very, very progressive and very exciting and change it into something that isn't able to either comment on the times we're living in today or to give us a better idea of the time in which it was written. I would highly recommend that any of our interested listeners, whether or not they're planning to go see this at the Lucia Lortel Theater, where it's playing for, I think, another month or so, to go on to Project Gutenberg, and that's GUTENBERG.org, and look up the original script of the New York idea, because I think that it really is just an astonishing example of how someone can change a play and really ruin what made it special and probably worth reviving in the first place. There are good things about this production. Some of the actors are good people. Patricia Connolly is in it. She plays kind of the very high-minded aunt, and Peter Maloney has a supporting role. Michael Countryman, Joey Slotnick are in it. Jeremy Shamos plays the sort of jilted husband whose wife Cynthia is leaving him for the lawyer, and he's always very good. He was last seen, unfortunately, in the Broadway production of Elling, and it's interesting from the standpoint that you're seeing something that originated back at the beginning of the last century at a time where we don't see a lot of plays from. You see certainly plays that were written earlier and, of course, many plays that were written later, but that's sort of a lost period where so many things were changing in the world that we're not able – it's almost like it's a different language and a different place that these plays come from. So we don't see a lot from them today. And I think that if the way that these plays are being treated is the David Auburn route of completely revising them and trying to pass them off as the same thing, even though they're really not, I think it's probably better if we don't see them, or if we leave them to companies like the Mint Theater Company that can afford to do larger scale versions of these plays. The interesting thing is that the last time that the Atlantic Theater did something like this, they did it with Harley Granville Barker's The Voicey Inheritance. And it was basically a case where David Mamet came in. He reduced the number of characters, changed a couple of things around, but it was essentially the same play. And this, David Auburn cuts three characters, changes probably another three or four, but otherwise completely revises and refocuses the play. And I think that if you're going to adapt something for modern audiences, or let's face it, modern budgets, the best way to do it is to go more the David Mamet approach, because you still feel like you're seeing something close to what the original playwright had envisioned. And with the New York idea, you really aren't. So if you go to see it and you like it, that's wonderful. But be aware that it's not what Langdon Mitchell had in mind.
All right, Michael, why don't you tell us a little bit about Waiting for Godot?
Yeah, I assume you're referring to this news item about this production that's been halted because the estate objected to it. Maybe Matthew could just kind of summarize the situation, and then I'll weigh in.
It's pretty simple. I mean, this is a story that that I found earlier this week on Boston.com. Basically, there was a production at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst of Waiting for Godot that was directed by Christopher McElrone, and it was kind of acclaimed as being sort of one of the most visionary and exciting productions of Waiting for Godot ever, but the Samuel Beckett estate shut it down. And the reason that they apparently shut it down is because it was set in post-Katrina New Orleans. And I'm going to just quote directly from the Boston.com story here. And features two African-American men desperate for help as they wait on a rooftop surrounded by floodwaters. Now, the interesting thing about this for me is that according to this story, it's been done around the country since 2006. So it's not exactly a new property. It's not something that the Samuel Beckett estate didn't know about. According to this, they even approved it once, but they're shutting it down now. The question to me, though, that makes it interesting and that certainly ties it into the New York idea is that does this fit in with what Samuel Beckett had in mind for Waiting for Godot. And even if they don't change any of the dialogue or anything, does this constitute such a significant change that the nature of Waiting for Godot is changing as a result? This is something that a lot of people are going to have strong and divergent opinions about. My personal feeling, without having seen it, I want to make that clear, is that, yeah, this really does sort of make it something different. Samuel Beckett's play deals a lot with implicit Cold War nuclear apocalyptic angst, and certainly there are specifics within the generalities that, to my mind and my reading and my viewing of the play, relegate Waiting for Godot to basically a wasteland where these two bum kind of characters are waiting for a job from this Godot guy who keeps promising he'll come and hasn't shown up yet. And to me, that seems like it's very different from what you would get if you're setting something in New Orleans with water all around and two black guys sitting on top of a house waiting. I think it's, again, it's a very difficult situation. Without having seen it, I can't say how it works. But the other issue, of course, here is that the Samuel Beckett estate does have control over Waiting for Godot. This isn't like so many Shakespeare plays where they'll set it in the 1950s with Elvis, or they'll set one during World War II or World War I or World War III or whatever. Any place to avoid having to set it in Italy or England or Greece or wherever the play is set. This is a play that's, what, 55, 56 years old, that is still under copyright, at least in this country, and has rules that sort of need to be followed. And what I would love to hear is, I'd love to hear the Samuel Beckett Estate's idea about why they approved it and then why they took it away. But sight unseen, again, I want to make that clear, I have to side with them here, because to me, it sounds like they're really changing the play. Now, ideally, what Christopher McElrone and his company would have done would be to do a version, to do an adaptation, to use the actual word, that changes the characters' names and changes things around, but is obviously inspired by Waiting for Godot and called something else, so that there's no question that it's not connected to the actual Samuel Beckett play directly.
Yeah,
although that would have, I think, given both works something more. And whereas this has the potential, and apparently the Samuel Beckett estate agrees, of taking something away from Waiting for Godot, and also taking something away from a new work that could have shed light on the specifics of Katrina the way Waiting for Godot shed light on the specifics of the Cold War era.
Let me jump in for a quick second here to let everybody know that this would be a great topic for Peter to be involved with. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it this week due to the snow. He had a commitment that he was supposed to speak on Wednesday night, but due to the snow, they rescheduled for this morning, and he couldn't be with us, but hopefully he'll be back next week. I'm sure that Peter would have weighed in to let us know about there seems to be many different types of shows that are tangential and related to the Waiting for Godot work. And I wondered if either one of you have seen some of those.
I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, because from what I know of the Beckett estate, they're so strict that I think that they would probably go after anything, even if it was, or especially if it was billed as an adaptation.
Well, yeah, Michael, you might be right about that. But if someone, you know, calls it Waiting for Katrina or Waiting After Katrina or whatever,
yeah,
Waiting
exactly.
for Rescue, I don't know. I don't think the Samuel Beckett estate can do anything about it, because
parody,
fair use kind of thing where, I mean, if it's inspired by, but it's not passing itself off as that, I think that what the Samuel Beckett estate could do might be limited, but I don't know for sure.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure you're right about that. But regardless, I mean, it's interesting, especially the most interesting thing is, why did they first approve it and then renege on that? And you said it's been done since 2006.
That's correct.
That's quite some time. I mean, I can't help thinking that maybe it's for financial reasons, because if they had any moral objection or artistic objection to it, then what, you know, why was it okay for all those years and now it's not? Isn't that strange? What you said about specificity is interesting to me, Matthew, because I think, I mean, whatever Beckett's initial motivation was for writing the play, I think the thing about it that's most interesting is that its lack of specificity. I suspect maybe that's why there's an objection here, because if you do set it in post-Katrina, which sounds like a very interesting idea to me, but it does make it about something very, very specific, a specific event, whereas as it's normally staged and with the stage directions, it's sort of this just very generic no man's land. So I would guess that that's the reason, but I can only guess, because who knows what's going on in their heads, especially since it was fine for... since 2006, and now suddenly it's not.
Now, how do you guys feel overall about adapting a base work like they do so often with Shakespeare, as Matthew had mentioned before, or other things? And where is the line between a new interpretation of it and a totally new production?
Well, usually the general rule is that the text is left untouched. And the changes are in terms of interpretation, costuming, settings, where we're told that the play takes place and things like that. But of course, even if you do leave the text untouched, you can change the play significantly just in terms of changing it in those respects. I mean, I think we can both, we can all attest that we've seen radically reinterpreted versions of Shakespeare that worked brilliantly and others that did not, to put it mildly. And it's so subjective. So, I don't know. But I mean, I would have liked to have seen Waiting for Godot post-Katrina, but I guess I won't.
I think that Shakespeare is sort of a different circumstance for a couple of reasons. First of all, his plays are 600 years old and they're out of copyright. So really, legally, anyone can do anything they want to them. They're also extremely famous all over the world. Everyone has, well, with at least the core plays, everyone at least has a pretty strong idea of what the story is and what it's about, which gives directors a little bit more leeway to play around. Then there's also the issue of the actual plays themselves, and the fact that despite that many of them take place, as we said earlier, in other countries like Italy or Greece or whatever, for the most part, Shakespeare was writing them about the issues of his day in England. They were about the royalty there. They were about the history of the royalty there. They were about things that the people at that time and that place understood and were going through, but they were set in other places to camouflage certain things and to make them go down easier with audiences. But they were about what he was going through. So there's already a disconnect between the writing and the social context of the plays to begin with. And that also makes it easier to pull out the text of the play and put it somewhere else and have it work. With Waiting for Godot, yeah, Michael, I guess I didn't make myself very clear, but I think that it's part of the generality of Waiting for Godot that makes it so specific. The fact that it doesn't take place in a specific wasteland, or as you said, a no man's land, is one thing that gives directors room to move. But the fact that it's set in that kind of a place, to me, is very important. And there is a huge difference between being in a burned out place with a single tree and an endless road going in both directions, and a house that's being surrounded by floodwaters in Louisiana in 2005. There's an enormous difference there, just a world of difference. And I think that to conflate the idea that Samuel Beckett's play about the two people in the middle of nowhere waiting for Godot with two people on a house with floodwater around them waiting for rescue is really stretching things kind of beyond the Shakespeare level of adaptation. But again, you know, that's me. And as I want to stress this again for the 20th time, I didn't see it. Perhaps the Christopher McElroy version of it worked very well. I don't know. But from what I can tell from reading the Boston.com story, it seems like they really are making significant changes to the basic precepts of what Samuel Beckett laid out. And I think that they had the right to expect that would cause problems with the Beckett estate. And I'm not entirely sure they're unwarranted, but without having seen the play, it's hard for me to say for sure. So that's my gut instinct.
You guys had mentioned Shakespeare, and it reminded me of something I saw in the news this week. I don't know if you guys saw it. Did you see that there's going to be the Globe Theater is going to perform all of Shakespeare's plays in 38 different languages?
No.
Yeah, wow. I did hear about that.
Yeah, they're going to do it as this 2012 Cultural Olympiad over in London. I think that it's tied into the same time period when the Olympics are going to happen in London. That should be very interesting. And again, the Globe Theater, they're thinking outside the box there. And that's
it seems outside like, the ring, as the case may be.
That's a good point.
There was something else really interesting that's sort of related to that I heard about. I think it was last year. There was a college somewhere that was collaborating with an expert, with a linguistic expert, to do Midsummer Night's Dream in the original pronunciation, so that so that all of the things that look like they don't rhyme today would actually rhyme and would give us an idea of what they sounded like. And there's a video that's available on YouTube. If we can find it, I'm sure we'll link to it on the show page, that showed clips of them doing a scene from it in the OP, and it's really fascinating.
Wow.
And I think that there's something that is really kind of liberating about showing how Shakespeare can be done in OP, or can be done in English, or can be done in 38 different languages. And in a way, of course, that ties into the adaptation question of, when you're translating, aren't you automatically adapting? Because not every word automatically corresponds to the word in the language that you're doing. I think Michael Feingold coined a fantastic term for what he has done to plays: translaptations. A combination of translating and adapting, that they're really, you can't draw the line between the two, because they're so intertwined with each other. But I say bring it on. I think that'll be a really excellent way for people to experience Shakespeare in different ways, and I'm sure some of those will be very unique interpretations as well. So,
you know, Matthew, what you said about the original pronunciation, that's fascinating to me. But it seems to me if I were going to see a Shakespeare play done that way, I guess my first choice would be to see one that's set in England around that time.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea. I have I have no idea. I would think that the original pronunciation thing would not be a one-off experiment, but obviously it's not something that most groups are going to be able to do without the help of an expert in what the language actually sounded like at that point. So
I've heard some recordings of that, and also I think we've probably all heard recordings of Chaucer with the original pronunciation, and it's so fascinating.
To me, the most interesting part about it is you can completely understand it. Some of the words might be different, but the pronunciation sounds like a cross between Irish and American Southern. And it's completely understandable. You can understand every single word. And that's so rare, because so often, you know, the excuse that's given for Shakespeare adaptations and updatings and so on is that the language puts people at a remove. And it really isn't true. Some of the word choices aren't what we use today, but the language has changed very little over the last 600 years. And that's really the most fascinating aspect of it for me.
Enough of Shakespeare. We'll move on to The Milk Train Doesn't Stop Here Anymore. Matthew, why don't you tell us about that?
This play is bringing Olympia Dukakis back to the New York stage. And I for one, am very glad she's here. I think that The Milk Train Doesn't Stop Here Anymore is probably a difficult and a lesser known Tennessee Williams play, because it came from what I at least consider the beginning of his very, very dry period at the end of his career, when most of his plays weren't really, how do I put this diplomatically, good. And I have to admit that The Milk Train Doesn't Stop Here Anymore is not one of his best plays. But considering a lot of the stuff that was to come after it, it was originally done in the early 1960s. The first Broadway production was in 1963, and it showed up again the next year and has been There are like six different versions of it. He kept rewriting it, trying to make it work better. So obviously, even he knew that there were some issues with it. But if it's not up at the level of the Glass Menagerie or A Streetcar Named Desire or A Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, I think that it's really an intriguing work exploring the way that people die. The lead character, who's played by Olympia Dukakis, is named Flora Goforth. She is a Southern woman who is living in a villa in Italy at literally the very end of her life. It is the last day of her life. She's working with a secretary to finish her memoirs on a certain deadline. And she's very ill. She says she has neuralgia, but it's possible it might be something even worse than that. And her body is wasting away. And as the play unfolds, this young man climbs over the mountains and comes into the villa to see her. And he basically says that his job is to create mobiles that you hang up and they catch light and they spin. But it also turns out that he's something of a writer, and he has a history, a very strange history, in fact, of being around old women right before they die. And in fact, he's even earned the nickname of the Angel of Death as a result of this. His name is actually Christopher Flanders, and he's played here by Darren Petty. And there's kind of the question about, well, is he really who he says he is? Is he really the Angel of Death, or is he just a guy who has a habit of being in the wrong place at the wrong time? But because this is Tennessee Williams, he doesn't focus on the menial aspects of the plot so much as he does how does Flora deal with the fact that she's about ready to, if you'll pardon the pun, go forth. And it's fascinating to see her sort of trying to recapture her youth in some ways. She really strikes me as kind of what Amanda Wingfield might have looked like in her final years. She sort of is trying to capture the idea of being young and being desirable. And she certainly wants Christopher, who's 40 years old but is in very good shape and very good looking and has kind of a minor fling with the secretary. And she obviously wants him, but she also wants to do her memoirs, and she's fighting very intense pain. At one point, she dresses up in a kind of Southern belle outfit with a red wig, and at another point, she puts on a full Japanese kabuki costume and does a fan dance. And it's hard to explain. If you don't see the whole play, it's difficult to really see how it all fits together, but it does. I admit that I don't know the history of the various different versions of this play. So I can't say for sure what's changed since the original Broadway version through the rewrite and then the subsequent rewrites after that. I do know that this production, which premiered at Hartford Stages in 2008, it is directed by Michael Wilson, is kind of an amalgam of the various different versions. He took bits from here and bits from there to make a single show. I thought it worked actually pretty well. It's all over the place as a play. There are certainly multimedia elements of it where Flora sort of narrates the things that are happening to her in the past as it sort of melts with the present. She gets confused about where she is and where she's been. But Olympia Dukakis is excellent in it. She is very convincing as a very, very, very faded Southern belle and someone who's fighting the ravages of disease. And Darren Petty is excellent as Christopher Flanders. And he really keeps you guessing about whether or not he's inherently malicious or whether he really is just a very unlucky guy who happens to just show up when he really shouldn't. Interesting casting. Edward Hibbert is playing a role called the Witch of Capri, which was originated on Broadway, believe it or not, by Mildred Dunnock. This is a traditionally female role that he's playing. He plays it very well. He plays it very very flamboyantly. It's overtly gay, but that's okay because it's a bit of a strange role anyway. And the only person in the cast that I didn't really care for was Maggie Lacey. She was probably seen most often and most frequently in the Orphan's Home cycle, where she played the wife to the lead character. And she was going for really kind of a straight-laced sort of stolid kind of character here. I didn't think she got there. She just came across as garden variety frustration and not a lot of depth to it. And that didn't really interest me very much. But the play itself is really a unique piece of work. And it really showed that even when he was entering sort of the late portion of his career, Tennessee Williams was still very concerned with the death of the Old South and really the way that life sort of fades out in general. And it's a worthy production. It's at the Laura Pels Theater. It's one of Roundabout's off-Broadway spaces. It's, again, it's not a terrific play, but it really, it's an interesting look into the way that Tennessee Williams worked and what was on his mind. And there are still things about it that are very relevant about how we face life and how we face death. And from that standpoint, it's worth seeing, but don't go in expecting the Glass Menagerie if you don't know this, because it's not at that level. But I'm a big Tennessee Williams fan in general, and it's certainly it's always a pleasure to see one of his plays done well, and this is done well.
So next we're going to talk about Knickerbocker Holiday. Michael, got a chance to see that? Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, it was a great evening. Actually, it was two performances. I saw the first of the two at Alice Tully Hall. It was the Collegiate Chorale presented it. And Ted Sperling, who is very well known and very talented as a conductor, musical director, and stage director, in this case, did only the stage direction. The performance was conducted by James Bagwell. And it had an excellent cast: Victor Garber, Kelly O'Hara, Ben Davis, who is not, I think, that well known. One of his major credits was that he was one of the Marcellos in Baz Luhrmann's Broadway production of La Boheme. Superb baritone voice in the male lead. Christopher Fitzgerald, as his comic sidekick. We also had a guy named Bryce Pinkham, who I'm previously not that aware of. He was in Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson on Broadway. And David Garrison, Brad Oscar, Michael McCormick, Brooks Ashmanskas, Jeff Blumenkrantz. And it's a quite obscure, nowadays quite obscure, musical by Kurt Weill and Maxwell Anderson set in New Amsterdam. One of the main characters is Peter Stuyvesant, played by Victor Garber. And it's sort of a political satire. It's always so interesting to see those things resurrected from the early years. I did think it had a similar feel to Of the I Sing and some of those other political musicals of the day. Just basically very light tone, but it still makes its points about government, etc. But of course, since it's a musical, it also has a love story. And this show yielded, although the show itself is rarely ever done anymore, it yielded two standards: September Song, beautiful, beautiful song, and the slightly less well-known but equally gorgeous It Never Was You. So it was great. It's funny. I saw David Hyde Pierce in the audience that night, and then the following evening I saw him when I went to go see the American Songbook Fascinating Rhythm concert, which we'll talk about a little later. And when I saw him at Fascinating Rhythm, I said, "David, how did you enjoy the show last night?" He said, "Oh, it was great." He said, "Only in New York would you get to see a piece like that performed with that caliber of people." And, you know, I certainly couldn't argue with him. It was very special. I mean, the show is extremely strange. The tone is all over the place. One could not say that it's a well-made musical or even that it ultimately works that well, but it's got so much in it that's delightful and beautiful that it was a privilege to hear it with the original orchestrations played by a full orchestra and a huge chorus and leads of that caliber.
All right, Matthew, did you see the same performance, or did you see the next day?
I did see the same performance. In fact, I was in the row in front of David Hyde Pierce. It took me a minute to recognize him without the beard that he wore in Labatt, but it was definitely him. I agree with everything that Michael said. I would, however, like to expand on a couple of things. First of all, Michael is right that there was one Until the End of Time standard that came out of this, and that was September Song, and then there was the other one as well. But this is a really, really good score. I don't believe Kurt Weill ever was involved with a bad score on Broadway. But this one really just has some astonishing things in it. There are two songs that I think in particular are absolutely wonderful that probably no one has ever heard of. There's one that is on a Kurt Weill from Berlin to Broadway recording called The Scars, which Peter Stuyvesant sings toward the end of the show when he's about ready to marry Kelly O'Hara. And it's all about how men and women who were experienced before marriage might be good or bad to their potential new partners. And it's got some incredibly salacious lyrics in it that are uproariously funny, but that are so well camouflaged that they don't seem really dirty, but they actually are. It's really exciting to hear a song like that from in a show from 1938, when you usually think of like Cole Porter as being kind of the upper echelon of racy lyrics sort of hiding behind innocuous words and all that. So that's one. But my favorite song in the score is this one that's sung really early on between the Ben Davis character and, seriously now, I'm not making this up, Washington Irving, who's the narrator of the show. Some of you may know that he wrote a very famous satirical history of early New York, and he narrates the show, and it's sort of all constructed along the lines of that. But there's this great song called How Can You Tell an American? And they just basically sing about all the things that Americans do and that separates them from the other countries in the world. And they just basically conclude, well, you know, Americans are just going to do whatever they want. So if you like it, then if you do that, then you're an American at heart. And it's just this wonderful, bouncy, witty song that they also reprise at the end. And I think it's just, I think it's great. Kurt Weill wrote so many wonderful love songs and all that, but even his comedy numbers were wonderful in that. That was a great example. But for me, the most interesting thing about everything involved with Knickerbocker Holiday, Michael's right, it's a lot, it's like Of the I Sing and I'd Rather Be Right, in the fact that it's a political satire, but it's really interesting because it's not a liberal political satire. It is very, very vicious against Franklin Delano Roosevelt. There's even a character in the play named Roosevelt that you are supposed to imply was one of his great, 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 great ancestors. And really, you know, I think that Stephen Holden in his review in the Times said, well, it looks like something that would be written today about, you know, the Tea Party and the government, but it's told from the Tea Party's point of view. And that's very astute a way to put it. Whether you agree with it politically or not, it's just so interesting to see something that a year after I'd Rather Be Right, which had George M. Cohen as Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and really kind of a loving and just sort of gently poking kind of thing, this is really very anti-New Deal and anti-Social Security and all of that kind of stuff. And that's something that you see so rarely today in general. In fact, that you've seen rarely ever. So as a history piece from that standpoint, it's also fascinating. But again, the reason to have seen this and to buy the recording when it comes out, I think on Ghostlight later this year, is the score. Because if you don't know it, it's way up there in the Kurt Weill scores. Granted, you know, on the scale of 1 to 100, I don't think he ever wrote anything that rated less than a 90, but this is definitely in the top half of even that. It's got such wonderful stuff in it. It's so varied and so different from anything that he had done before or after. I would definitely recommend picking up the recording if you don't know it. And yeah, as Michael said, the cast you don't ever see, and the orchestra, full orchestra, is great. When Musicals in Mufti, the York Theatre Company sort of series of stage reading, did this, I think a couple of years ago, they did the whole book, which this concert didn't do. And I think this concert was right to not do the whole book, just for the record. But they didn't have a full orchestra. And when you hear it with all those violins and all of the flutes and stuff, it's an entirely different experience. And it really makes you realize how important real full-size orchestras are to serious musical theater. And that recording will be just an invaluable document of something that's needed one for 7 decades. And hopefully the other Kurt Weill scores that haven't yet received similar treatments, like One Touch of Venus and Love Life, will get those sooner rather than later. I think that this is going to be a very special recording, and it was a very special concert, and I am really very happy that I got a chance to see it.
And one other thing that's going to be special about the recording is we have so very few live recordings of musical theater pieces, and I believe that that's what this is going to be. I don't think they're going to reassemble in the studio. I think they recorded both performances, and they're going to just draw from that. And there is something, you know, just very exciting about a live recording, even though they sometimes have little imperfections. There's that aliveness, that spontaneity that you really can't get in the studio. So that's one more wonderful thing. Another delight of this show was, I always love when you see these ancient musicals and they have these corny old jokes that still work. And still get can get an audience laughing in 2011. There were some typical jokes about flushing Queens, and there were some jokes about Boston and Connecticut. And you know, I guess they were cheap humor, but they were still funny. And it's really funny to hear humor like that lasting through the ages. I think is great. Another thing is some of the supporting characters in this show. Matthew mentioned Roosevelt, but there's also the character played by Brooks Osmanskas was actually called Van Cortlandt, as in the park. And then we had Jeff Blumenkrantz's Van Rensselaer. I think that's a kind of a familiar name. You know, the rich history of New Amsterdam and just how much of it is still with us in terms of names of people on buildings and parks and things like that. It's really, really amazing.
Yeah, I think that this show really does demonstrate that certain kinds of humor never died, no matter how much you may want them to keel over. But it's really done as sort of a vaudeville, shticky kind of thing. And it's fascinating because if you think about it, it's all Dutch characters, as in Dutch, you know, from the country. But it's also, quote unquote, Dutch comedy. And it's such a great juxtaposition to see Dutch characters that are Dutch characters. And I think that's probably why it still works after so many years, that you can say what you want about the sort of low nature of vaudeville and Weber and Fields kind of comedy, but it was really timeless. And if it still is working 70 years later, when everyone involved with the original show is dead, everyone in the government then is dead, and most of the audiences who would have known anything about the era are dead, I would imagine in another 70 years or another 150 years, a lot of these jokes are still going to get laughs, because they lock on to things that go beyond of the moment cheap shots that characterize so much of comedy today. I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. Not that this show should necessarily be revived in 70 years or 150 years or ever, really. I don't know how well it would work, but I do think that some of the things that made us laugh earlier this week will continue to make people laugh in the future if they're hurt.
Just to clarify, Matthew, in case not everyone knows, Dutch comedy was the term that for some reason was given to this kind of Yiddish comedy that existed in shows in vaudeville in the early years of the 20th century. I'm not sure why they called it that. I don't remember the reason. But anyway, so it was I guess a joke in itself that we had these literal Dutch characters doing Dutch, you know, meaning Yiddish humor in Knickerbocker Holiday. And like you said, you know, most of it still works, you know, if it's done well, as it was by, you know, I mean, what a great cast, Brad Oscar, Michael McCormick, really, really excellent people.
The Council of Government Elders, it was like a who's who of Broadway comedians, of the best Broadway comedians that we have today. It was so great to see them all on one stage at the same time. It couldn't help but be funny, and it really was.
Next thing on our agenda is Michael got to see Fascinating Rhythm. Michael, why don't you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. This was part of the American Songbook series, which takes place mostly in the incredible Allen Room in the Time Warner Center. They do great, great concerts. This one was titled Fascinating Rhythm. It was, as you might have guessed, music of the Gershwins. Rob Fisher was the musical director and onstage narrator and pianist. And there was a wonderful little combo. And his guests were Victoria Clark, who, you know, was one of my all-time favorites, and Norm Lewis, who I didn't know this, but he casually mentioned that, Rob mentioned that Norm had come back from London especially to do this concert, and he made it sound like Norm had moved there permanently, which were either of you guys aware of this?
No. No, I would not. It's not.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if so, that's I don't know the reason. I mean, that's a loss to the New York Theater. I mean, hopefully he'll keep coming back if he did in fact move there permanently, because he has one of the most beautiful voices, you know, in the history of the musical theater. And I think we haven't heard as much of him as I would have liked anyway. So. Yeah, so this was just a great evening of standards and lesser known songs, and one of the highlights was when Sheldon Harnick came on just to do the Gershwin song "Blah Blah Blah," which was just so delightful. He sort of he gave a great performance today. In fact, he was so good performance wise that I thought, gee, I wonder if he ever thought of playing Tevye in Fiddler when he was younger. He was a great performer. And the Allen Room is an amazing space with three-story tall windows overlooking the southwest corner of Central Park. And as it happened, the night that we were there was the night of the most recent blizzard. So during the show, all of a sudden this blizzard came in, and it was kind of amazing to see that through the windows. Aside from what was going on stage, which was really incredible music performed by, you know, the top people in their field. And on the subject, by the way, of price, you know, a lot of these types of things can be very pricey, but this one, not so much. I mean, there's no food involved as if, you know, as when you go to see something at Feinstein's or the Oak Room. So that obviously that makes a difference. But I double checked, and for Kate Baldwin's upcoming concert, they have table seating right down front, only about, I guess, maybe five or six tables. And that's $85 a ticket. But then the orchestra is $70 and $55. And then the mezzanine is $55 and $40. And those are the, you know, the full prices. I'm not talking with discount codes or anything like that. So to me, that's not a lot of money to pay for artists of this caliber in a room like that. So please pay attention to the American Songbook series. They have coming up Barbara Cook had rescheduled a concert that she was to have done earlier, and that's happening on February 15th. I think it's probably already sold out. Also, I'm sorry, on February 5th, we have Anika Nani Rose is there. And then Kate Baldwin is on February 19th, and Raul Esparza is on February 18th. So yeah, get yourself on their mailing list if you're not already on it. It's a wonderful, wonderful series.
That list of people that you mentioned, you know, why doesn't Lincoln Center try to get somebody in there with talent?
it's
astounding, you know, we're in New York City here. Well, that's great. You know, it's so sad that these things happen for such a short period of time, because there's so many people, I'm sure, beyond myself, who listen to this and say, oh, I wish I had seen this. But I guess that's the nature of the beast.
Well, yeah, you know, it's I've often said this to friends, and they to me, that the downside, if you look at it that way, of living in New York is that you kind of, it's hard to feel you're not missing stuff all the time.
Yeah, it's
because there's so much going on that's so good, and some of it, as you say, for one performance or two performances only, and you could, you know, spend your life trying to, assuming you can afford it in the first place, just trying to schedule to see stuff that you really want to see.
Yeah, you know, you talk to Matthew and Peter, who see almost everything, and still, in fact, they could possibly miss great things, because sometimes, especially on the Monday nights when there's benefits and it's probably Matthew and Peter's only night off, you know, you don't want to miss those one-time things. How about it, Matthew? You know, is there stuff that you, every season that happens, that you miss, that you regret?
Every season, no matter how hard I try. The most shows I've ever seen in one year, I think, is 298. And even that year, there was stuff I wanted to see I just couldn't get to. It's sort of the way of the world. I mean, it's wonderful that New York has so many just outstanding opportunities for seeing new works and old works and literally the best talent that you can find to do this stuff in the entire world. But there's so much of it that the double-edged sword nature of it is you can't get to everything even if you want to. So it's just you do your best with the time you have and the money you have, and you pick the things that you think are going to interest you most. But no matter what you do, there's always going to be a Monday where there are two things, or a show that runs a week and you can't see it because you're seeing other stuff, or you have to work at your day job or whatever. There's no way around it, unfortunately, but it's still, there's just nowhere else quite like it for having the opportunities to miss so many wonderful things because you're seeing so many other wonderful things.
Speaking of which, we have some news on the forefront. In the fall of 2011, it seems like James Franco has joined with Nicole Kidman in The Sweet Bird of Youth that's coming in. What do you guys think of this? James Franco is all of a sudden everywhere.
That's about as big as you can get. Can you imagine what it's going to be like at the stage door? I don't even want to think about it.
I don't know if the two of you saw James Franco on the Jon Stewart show, The Daily Show, this week. It was the day that he was nominated for his Academy Award. And Jon asked him what he did that day. And he said that, I don't know if you know, he's a doctoral student in English composition at Yale University. And he said that he heard the announcement and then he did a remote for the Today Show. Then he went to class. And John Stewart said, "You went to class, you know? Couldn't you call in and say, hey, you know, I got nominated for an Academy Award, you know?
Couldn't you cut?"
and he says, "No. It was a poetry class on Keats or something like that." And I will see if I could dig up this clip and link to it on the show page because it's very charming to watch. And if he's anything like he is in the things that we've seen him on screen and in these interviews with Jon Stewart, this might be the ticket to get, you know, the Fences of last season ticket. So you might want to get these Sweet Bird of Youth tickets early. And he's hosting the Oscars, and so maybe he's falling into this pattern of Neil Patrick Harris, where he does some really big things and he'll host the Oscars. Maybe he'll host the Tonys next year. Mm. You know, we'll see. He and Nicole, although I sort of feel like he's a bigger star than her right now, but I could be wrong about that. What do you guys think?
Well, Nicole Kidman, of course, was just nominated for an Oscar for Rabbit Hole. So yep. It's possible she might be on the way back up again. I don't know. I still see her as a pretty big star and a pretty big name. He might be a little bit hotter than her right now.
Yeah.
But she's no slouch in the fame department either. So.
No, of course not.
She did have a run of really unfortunate luck with several projects, but yes, she's still, you know, the name recognition, and she is terrific in Rabbit Hole. So maybe it is a resurgence for her.
Yeah, you know, the Academy Awards are coming up soon. And although I realize that Matthew is not so much a film file, Michael, do you watch a lot of the nominated films? Do you have anything to weigh in on there?
I don't, probably in this similar situation to Matthew, just for lack of time, I don't get to see a lot. But I'm trying to be more proactive this year. And I recently just saw The King's Speech, which, if anyone, oh my God, just an amazing film. And
would you think that would convert to stage?
You know, I think it actually, now that you mention it, it probably would. Not that anyone would ever do it, but yeah, because it's mostly about speech and ideas and you know, character relationships rather than about spectacle and special effects, God knows. So yeah, that's an interesting thought.
If the film that's nominated happens to be a children's film, I might have seen it. But other than that...
Well, James, I'm sure that you saw Toy Story 3, for example.
Yes.
And that's
yes.
certainly nominated.
And how about,
Twisted?
I missed Tangled. I wanted to see
Tangled. Tangled, yeah. Not Twisted, yeah. Tangled was great. I love Tangled. And Peter mentioned a few weeks ago that he saw Tangled and loved it as well. Yeah, that's a real good one.
But really, James Franco, I mean, you know, generally speaking, with some exceptions, when people come to Broadway, when stars come to Broadway, it's usually not when they're at the very height of their popularity. But in this case, he certainly is. And And I have to wonder, I don't know if it's been announced, I don't think it has, how much of a commitment he's going to make to this in terms of time. You know, it is so interesting. Didn't Fences run only about 3 months? Isn't that right?
Yeah.
It sounds about right, yeah.
And did we ever figure out or discuss how, you know, how the money worked for that? Because there's just no way that they could ever conceivably make their money back in that amount of time.
Well, Michael, I'm assuming that extremely high ticket prices will play a very large role in that here.
Right.
They probably know that with Nicole Kidman and James Franco in the leads, they can charge whatever they want and they will still sell out every performance. I mean, that's the way this normally goes.
Yeah, but you still need, a certain a run of a certain length just to get enough people into, I mean, I wonder if he's going to sign for 6 months, or if both of them will sign for 6 months. I guess we'll know soon.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because it's a tough thing to make work in a very short run. And we've seen other shows that have tried to recast with other stars, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I think we've talked about that before here.
But James, would you care to offer an, I mean, do we know how that worked with Fences? I mean, did
Fences made a lot of money? They covered their costs and walked away with more than they came with.
Really? So they just, I mean, did they have a lot of premium ticket prices?
Well, I mean, you know, if you just basically do the math, let me see if I can pull up the Fences.
That's amazing to me. I mean, it had at least one, presumably one star salary. I mean, maybe he worked for a little less just because for love of the project. 3 months is nothing, you know.
Fences was at the court. It was pulling in north of $1 million a week, running at 101.5%. Yeah, they covered their expenses plus some there. I mean, even if Denzel worked for $20,000 a week, you know, even if he worked for $50,000 a week, he was still, they were pulling in $1 million.
Well, I guess if it's a non-musical, that's obviously a major, because you don't have to pay,
you know, 20,
all of those other people.
Yeah, $20,000 a week is, you know, the relative star salary type of thing that you would expect. You know, Denzel's a little bit bigger. Maybe he did a $30,000, $35,000, $40,000 a week, which, you know, $20,000 a week is $1 million a year, and $40,000 a week is $2 million a year. You take the numbers from there, but you know, easily, they were doing these numbers because it was such an impossible ticket to get. The average ticket price was $120.
Wow.
You know, Michael, it's interesting that you brought up the question about musicals, because the big difference between Sweet Bird of Youth and Fences is that Sweet Bird of Youth has a much bigger cast.
Yes.
It has 22 roles in it.
Yes.
So I would think that if you have Nicole Kidman and James Franco in there, who are both going to be making a lot of money, I would think, that's going to change the math a little bit. So they might have to run a little bit longer. But yeah, I still think that the ticket prices are going to be higher than average. And has it been said what theater it's going to play in yet? Because I mean, that if it's in a bigger, I mean, the court is 800 some seats. It's not very big. So I think that if it plays in a larger theater, that would also help them make their money back faster. Not that I think they'll have any trouble with Sweet Bird of Youth, by the way, but I think that a larger theater will make a big difference here.
Yeah, I think that it's still too far out to see which theater is going to be the best opportunity for them to go into whatever they're going into.
Yeah, I don't think Wicked is going to close anytime soon, but that's probably the yes. ideal for them.
They still have Radio City Music Hall. You know?
Good
yeah,
point.
They could do it at the Met and they'd probably sell out.
Absolutely. We did see that Rich Nazudian from the Toronto Star, another major reviewer, has reviewed Spider-Man. It seems, and Matthew had mentioned before we get on this call today that, who's deciding tomorrow, Matthew?
The New York Drama Critics Circle.
Is deciding if they're going to review Spider-Man before opening night or not. So I guess we'll have more to talk about next week.
Well, yeah, one thing that has been brought up is that it seems as though the changes that have been made recently have been made, and that they're not all that extensive. So the question is, you know, people are questioning whether they really needed to delay the opening for that long. And some people are of the opinion that it's not that they needed the time to put in changes so much as that they do want to keep the critics away as long as possible.
Yeah, that seems to be what they are doing. Mamma Mia didn't care about the reviews.
I think we all agree that the success or failure of Spider-Man will really come down to word of mouth. I mean, I'm kind of convinced of that. I think that even if it gets the worst reviews in the history of the theater, that if people tell their friends that they liked it and had a great time, that it probably won't matter at all. But I don't know what the word of mouth is, because the people I'm hearing from are not your average theater goers. So, and as we discussed, I think a bigger problem for them is the fact that apparently the story of Spider-Man has been changed at the behest of Julie Taymor. So that's going to be a much bigger problem for them than whatever critic from whatever newspaper or website says.
Sure, absolutely. All right, so we have stuff to talk about in the future. We should probably wrap up here. I just want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio logo. Right below that logo is a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes. You can also get This Week on Broadway through the Zune Marketplace, through Google's application Listen, also through the application Stitcher, S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R. And Stitcher is an application that will let you listen to our podcast on the fly so that you don't have to download it. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio. That's Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you are sitting at your computer and you'd like to listen to it, it'll be there too. You can contact us. I haven't mentioned it in a few weeks. I've been meaning to. Our contact information for all of us, Peter, Michael, Matthew, and I, are on the show page at BroadwayStars.com/Broadway Radio. And you can reach us there, or you can just go to the front page of BroadwayStars.com, and on the upper right-hand corner, there's a contact form, and you can email us. You can also leave us a voicemail by calling 646-873-7695. And if you do leave us a voicemail, we may play it on the podcast. So on behalf of Matthew Murray and Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, who will hopefully be back next week, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
When lovely Venus lies beside her lord and master Mars, they mutually profit by their scars.